burning trial by fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 trial by fire.
Welcome to this edition of Justice Team Podcast. Today we're talking cannabis law. We have a couple superstars in here that are in that space. Our viewers are going to get a little snippet of what's going on in the cannabis industry in the state of California, which has the best grow, right, Brad?
I wouldn't know.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, so he's also a liar. He's also doing our color commentary today. I'm Robert Simon. This is Brad Simon. He's wearing the red, so he gets to do the color. So first, we have Josiah Young in, and he's licensed both New York and California. He's the brother at law. If you go to his website, does a lot of cannabis, a lot of activist stuff, very politically connected. He's up in Sacramento, has a lot of influencers, give a lot of, you know, talk out there for Cedric the Entertainer. I saw Matt Barnes.
Yes.
Singing your praises, right? So, yeah, Josiah, thanks for coming on, brother.
Thank you, my brother, for having me, man. Love what you guys are doing with the Justice Team, Justice HQ. You guys are doing rock star lawyer shit, stuff I look up to, so good deal.
Hey, what's your associate's name that just popped on?
That's Lord Star, because he rules the space around here. Goes where he wants.
All right, and we also have on Raza Lawrence, who's a Harvard-educated lawyer. He's partnered with Allison Margolin, so Margolin and Lawrence, and, you know, started out. You know, Raza, you were doing first the criminal law with people getting pinched for weed. By the way, are we talking weed, pot, herb? What do we call it? Is it a generational thing? Raza, this is for you, bro. Go.
You know, I like weed. I know that it's shifted to cannabis a lot in the law, but it doesn't really matter what word you use. But I like weed. I still use the word marijuana quite a bunch.
What's the nomenclature for the kids? What's the new hip slang for the kids?
You know, I don't know. I'm
don't endeavor. I was going to say
you're talking. What the kids are talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, Raza, you've been in this space and the pioneers, you know, at your firm for a long time. You know, you guys were the first ones to kind of take this on. And, you know, I know Allison's dad, Bruce, was kind of the pioneer for the decriminalization of weed, you know, back in the 70s, right? I mean, so just walk us through your journey of how you got into this and why you're passionate about it.
Yeah, sure. So we did weed criminal cases, felony cases was our main practice for several years. And it's, you know, the decriminalization, it's still a work in progress. I was just up in Siskiyou County, California, a couple of days ago, helping someone who was stuck in jail on a $3 million bail on a marijuana case. Kind of ridiculous. Luckily, we got him out of jail. But we did felony cases for a long time in criminal courts until just recently in California. Thousands of people were still getting sent to prison for marijuana under Kamala Harris. A lot of people were commonly imprisoned just not too long ago. So it's technically legal now in California, but with the federal law still being what it is and making it illegal, there's still a lot of people also in federal prison.
Let's talk about that hybrid situation. We have a state that allows it, but the country that doesn't. So how does it interplay with like your practice and people in general in California?
Yeah, it creates all kinds of problems. That's why cannabis businesses can't use banks for the most part, because it's illegal under federal law. Banks are usually fairly conservative in their approach to things. But banks for a long time, the government would use asset forfeiture to basically take all the money out of the accounts if they thought it had anything to do with marijuana. So banks are still a little paranoid about that. They don't want to lose all their money. And even though the federal government is generally not enforcing their laws against state licensed businesses, they can at any time. I know Biden and Harris have a history of being anti-marijuana and pro-mass incarceration, pro-drug war. So no one's really sure how this is going to move forward. But under the U.S. Constitution, the Supremacy Clause, if there's a conflict between federal law and state law, the federal law controls. So technically, that's still the law of the land. It's a Schedule I substance with no medical, classified as having no medical benefit and a high potential for abuse. So until the federal law changes, we're still in this sort of weird gray area where you know, there's a lot of people who are willing to take the risks to start a cannabis business, but a lot of people are still worried and they're not willing to openly violate federal law all the time. It's an issue for even for attorneys practicing in this area, because lawyers, by helping cannabis businesses, are, you know, technically they could be accused of aiding and abetting federal law violations, or taking part in a conspiracy to violate federal law. So there's been a long time concern, what can they even do in this business? And you know, how can they be blatantly violating federal law, and what are the consequences for lawyers?
Many billboards pop up that we hadn't seen before, specifically, you know, Ease, Hyperwolf. I didn't know what that was until I looked it up while I was driving in my car, which was terrible, but good advertising for them. So Josiah, why don't you walk us through, like, kind of the evolution and how this business has changed from pre-COVID to post-COVID, and it's kind of exploded, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for the question. Pre-COVID and post-COVID, what you've seen is that, you know, you mentioned a billboard for a delivery company like Ease. And what you saw was that cannabis was just determined to be essential for one reason or another. You know, to somebody, it was a necessary substance during the COVID pandemic and all the shutdowns. So what you started seeing was cannabis businesses, while other businesses were struggling, were actually still ramping up. You know, they were seeing, they were gaining new market share. You're getting people who traditionally they may have been at work all day and weren't looking to, you know, puff a 420 joint or something, but now they have more flexibility in their schedule. A lot of people concerned with, you know, Zoom burnout and all of that. So cannabis just kept rising in terms of just use, not even how, you know, the market is playing out, but just people deciding to recreationally use. And we're also just in the very nascent stages of the market, right? It just got legalized in California, at least recreationally, 2018 or so. So now everyone is able to go to the store. I had my dad come out as a quick antidote, and he came from the East Coast, and I took him to a dispensary to check it out. And he was like, "This is a long way from Brooklyn, son." You know what I mean? Because he grew up in an era where you can't have a gram. And I grew up in that same era too. So I think that that's kind of also part of the analysis when you're talking about what's it like pre-COVID, post-COVID. You're also just looking at the fact that this industry is just continuing to grow. So you're going to see more creative marketing. You're going to see more places where you're going to get access to the substance, whether it's recreational or medical. You know, the access is going to increase. And especially as federal regulation continues to unwrap itself, the industry is just growing.
Let's talk a little more of that weed speak back in New York. So Chuck Schumer was on record saying he wanted to do a little more, make it federally. I mean, I saw a little bit of push of that. So is there any momentum? I know we had the past of Biden-Harris, but then we have Schumer saying something else. So is there anything on the horizon that might be a little more lenient on this?
You know, you mentioned I've spent some time in the advocacy space and political connectedness. And so what I know is that you don't know. You know, obviously people have been predicting this for a while. I've looked at, you know, mentors and people who have been in the cannabis legalization space for 20, 30 years. And they're like, "Man, I thought this was going to be done 15 years ago." You know, so am I optimistic and hopeful that this administration will move? Yeah. I mean, we've seen continuous movement. We've seen, I think there's a new piece of legislation introduced by some Republican law, federal lawmakers, saying that, again, you know, an attempt at descheduling cannabis. There's been talk of descheduling over the past couple of years. I think the farm bill and the fact that CBD and cannabis flower that's basically less than a certain amount of THC content is now legal. I think that's a huge step in the right direction, because a lot of the prohibition around cannabis was also crossing over, not only because of the local, you know, make you crazy effects, but just like on the agricultural impact on cotton and on our economy, right? So the fact that they're now loosening up some of these regulations and letting people sell cannabis, albeit, you know, THC-less,
well, that's not like we see the, you know, ones for Ease. There's one in the South Bay called Relief Club that does a lot of stuff on the beach. So how are they able to have a, you know, what does it mean to have a license? So
how do you get that license?
Yeah, Rosa,
how difficult is it to get a license right now?
Well, that's one of the problems, at least in California. It can be extremely difficult to get a license. The regulations are very burdensome. The taxes and expenses are very high. So the legalization, it was supposed to be a sort of making up for the war on drugs and trying to help the people who have been harmed, especially in minority communities, by the drug war. You know, Richard Nixon started the drug war originally with the goal of targeting Black people and hippies, and those groups have really suffered. I know Black people have gotten arrested for marijuana at something like four times the rate of white people, even though both groups have similar usage rates of marijuana. So the intention was that the legalization was supposed to help the people who were harmed by the war on drugs, be a form of reparations. But instead, at least in California, you're seeing the licenses mostly go to these large corporate interests There's been corruption also, the way the government artificially limits the number of licenses. So California hopefully will learn from its mistakes in rolling out legalization and try to streamline and simplify the process so more regular people can start small businesses and succeed in the industry. But it's just the way it's set up right now, it's very
my understanding, like, for instance, at Riverside, I heard they're going to have it soon to be like a free-for-all for getting the licenses. And I heard people that are in the space say that it's still, the cannabis industry is still an old boys club. Like, you have to be like, and be wrapped into the grow and know all those things. So some of them are very anti these big corporations that are buying in and doing it. Like, we used to see Mad Men all over the place in Southern California. Don't anymore, right? Like, why does that happen? It just, I see you laughing and shaking your head. Like, why does that happen?
Well, first, before I answer that question, I wanted to take a step back and just piggyback on something Raza said in terms of the importance of the social equity programs. In my estimation, a lot of it is rhetorical, right? But it has to be done that way. That you can't overnight, aside from the harms that have in fact impacted the community and my community particularly, you still also have to look at the fact that there were a huge criminal, like, money-making enterprise on the government side, right, by criminalizing cannabis. And now all of a sudden, it's just legal. There has to be a replacement of that revenue source, right? And so basically, when you're looking at this, I just wanted to be clear that, like, the policies have to adjust for an overarching reality, which is people have been going to jail for years over this, and now all of a sudden it's a big money-making bonanza. So the intentions are right, but I think to Roz's point, it's still difficult. It's difficult for somebody who's undercapitalized to make a successful business. I don't care if you're doing a hot dog cart. If you don't have enough money to make that thing go the way it needs to go, you're not going to make it go that way. So the regulatory hurdles are there.
So is this regulated by the state, where the state of California is getting an increase in tax revenue because of the legalization of this?
Yeah, I mean, I raised the point about that because some of the tax revenue, there is an increase in tax revenue, clear cut, that's going to the state and local municipalities, and a lot of that is going back into law enforcement, which that's what I'm saying. And where else are you going to replace those budgets if you're not arresting people for the same substance? So it's interesting, and there's a lot involved in the policy. I just kind of wanted to highlight the fact that I think the notion of the policy is important. You can't just all of a sudden turn on money-making opportunities for a good old boys network when people have been, criminalized for years.
Yeah, and Raza, let me ask you this question. So YCEs, Relief Club, these different delivery services, how are they able to do that if they're not the ones, like, I assume East doesn't have a license that they're coming from. I mean, how does that work?
Well, East ends up working with people who are able to acquire the license. They enter into these sort of management agreements. And that's one of the issues in California is a lot of these big corporations will come in and do management agreements and basically suck out all of the profits from the social equity people who get the licenses in the first place. So that's basically what Ease does. It goes and tries to partner with people who are able to acquire these licenses, which are supposed to, in LA at least, are supposed to be going to the social equity candidates. But in reality, it's the big corporate interests who end up benefiting. California still has a huge illicit market right now because of the difficulty of getting the licenses and the high taxes and burdensome regulations. My view is that this should all be simplified and they should just let the market sort it out. The best cannabis growers and sellers will rise to the top and others might go out of business, but there's no reason to artificially limit the licenses and only give them to people with friends on the city government and that kind of thing.
And if I may add, I wanted to say something about Ease. I'm here representing Josiah Young Law, right? That's my brand. You can check me out at josiahyounglaw.com or Josiah Young Law on IG. But I also am friends with Ease. I have worked with Ease. So I want to say on the positive side of what they're doing, they have a social equity program called the Momentum Program, where they're not just exclusively extracting things, but they have a fund that's set up to give grants and resources and support to some of these social equity brands. They're taking these social equity brands and they're putting on their platform. And once you get on the Ease carousel, that's going to take your brand sales through the roof from where you were able to do through whatever traditional marketing channels that you were doing. So I don't think anything out there is perfect. As I said, I know that there's issues around social equity, but I also want to champion what Ease is doing a good job of with the Momentum program. And, as you mentioned earlier, a client and partner of mine, Matt Barnes, is a part of that Momentum program with E. So I want to give a shout out to the good work being done there. And then also I wanted to say the way that people are doing these creative management agreements, or kind of just taking non-licensed entities but doing quasi flower touching business, people across the board are doing that, right? White labeling flower or creating a brand that's in demand and letting a licensed cultivator go ahead and grow that and run that through the distribution channel. So it's just the main takeaway from our audience is like, there are a lot of ways to be creative and, you know, be in the industry without actually having the physical license.
You could have a specialization within having the licenses. Maybe it's distribution. Maybe it's just you running your brand. Maybe it's the delivery service because, I mean, who manages a lot? Because, you know, as Raza said, you can't, the banks don't want to touch this stuff, the big banks. So I've heard people getting taken off of Shopify because they used to have their, you know, run their services on there because Shopify don't want to deal with it. So what is, like, what's the solution here for money being? I mean,
a patchwork of everything. Yeah, cash is accepted by most of the governments, right? So you can go in your local municipality and you can pay your taxes, you know, $500,000 in cash if need be, which is something that just never would have happened before. You know, you would have created so much tax problems. And the tax issues are still there for the cannabis industry too, right? Given IRS code 280E, I'm sure every lawyer will tell you we don't give tax advice. But at the same time, you know, when you're looking at a cannabis business, you can imagine that you're paying a gross tax. You're going to pay pretty much, you're not going to get those normal business deductions for your office space and for your meals and for your staff. So that's just a burden on the industry generally, is that the fact that you're having this tax trouble. But otherwise, you're half people are, and you know, Raza pointed something out earlier. It's hard to advise as an attorney because you can't give illegal advice, right? So I always advise my clients to follow all the rules. But a lot of them, you know, who may not be our clients or whatever, are doing it all types of things, making up what type of company they are, changing the paperwork, making sure it's not showing, and people get in trouble for that. You know, they get caught and then they say you're embezzling or you're doing some type of wire fraud. But people are really doing some patchwork of not trying to let the banks know that they're doing cannabis business, because then that means, no, you can't bank with us.
Yeah, Raza, I've heard people, like, a lot of, in the warehouse industry, a lot of people are charging exorbitant amounts for purchase or warehouse because they know that people want to go and do grows there. You know, are there different cities that have different regulations within California that also screw with the state? You know, is it harder to do something in one city as opposed to the next?
Yeah, absolutely. And California is a little unusual in that it lets all of the local governments set their own cannabis policies. I would say most local governments still have total bans on commercial cannabis activity. But there are, and the places that do allow it, it's different in every city how to get a license. Some places it's a lottery. Some places it's a scoring system. Some places it's first come, first served, which the city of Los Angeles gave out 200 licenses recently for cannabis storefronts, but they were taken up in basically a matter of seconds. It was the whole thing turned into a mess, and then it was audited. But there's, I think there's a lot of corruption going on because so much power is given to local governments, and that the incentive is to set up systems where the local politicians can get under the table payments or get the licenses to their friends. So that's part of the problem, I think, is local governments have so much ability to set their own policies that it ends up going in sort of
Are you saying that there is corruption in politics?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that California could do a much better job streamlining its regulations to eliminate the corruption. And we've learned a lot of lessons over these past couple of years about what does not work.
Dude, from like California water boards to cannabis licenses, man, it is just some fucked up shit out there, right? I mean,
yeah. So where are the most growing done? I assume it's Northern California, but right now, can it be anywhere?
Well, I'll jump in and say, I think California has a history of being the best grow, you know, agricultural zone in the world, basically, or one of the best. You know, everyone says come to kind of the Northern California, and that's where you're going to get the best. So the Emerald Triangle up there in Humboldt County, people are doing the really good outdoor sun grown, as they call it. And, you know, people like doing indoor grows because you can control the temperature and the variables and the settings and ultimately the output of your flower a lot better indoors. But, you know, there's a trade-off between sun-grown and indoor just from the sun's perspective, also from a power and energy perspective, right? You can probably be more cost-efficient growing outdoors. But to answer your question in one sentence, a lot of outdoor up north for sure, but everywhere across the state, people are growing. Anywhere where it's commercially allowed, I'm sure that people find warehouses and little plots of land, and they're planting seeds.
I get my peaches out of Georgia. I get my weed in California.
Right? Yeah.
But you know, I heard they used to call that up there Murder Mountain
because it's dangerous. Because you got a lot of black market stuff going on.
That's what I heard. You know, my guys in the industry say, you know, making, you know, running their teens and clones up there, that they, you know, it's just called Murder Mountain. Yeah, you know, I've seen some documentaries on it, so it's gonna be a little careful.
I certainly give a lot of, I mean, you know, I'm in this space, I'm occupying this space. I've been in since the beginning of the recreational market here in California. It's been medically legal since '96. And so there's a deeply entrenched group on base up there, and I'd be wrong if I didn't give full deference to just let them do whatever they're doing up there. You know, I'm happy to help from Sacramento, but there's a definite community up there that knows what they're doing.
Yeah. So, Raza, can you walk us through just generally, man, like what's going on? Look, what do you think this space is going to next? I mean, you're fighting the decriminalization, you know, trying to weed out the federal versus state BS. So, walk us down. What do you think is going to happen in the next 12 months, 12 to 18 months?
Well, Joe Biden has said his plan is to move it to Schedule 2 under federal law, and that schedule is OxyContin and fentanyl, and it would allow people to get it through prescriptions. But is that if you go that route, it'll be giant pharmaceutical companies who will take over the industry. I don't think that's the way to go. I know the MORE Act, which was it passed the Congress but not the Senate recently, that would have completely descheduled marijuana. And I know there's another law that was proposed by Republicans, I believe it was mentioned earlier, that would also deschedule it. But I think that that's the route that we're likely to see, is it's removed from the federal schedules and basically left to the states to regulate.
Yeah. So what can, you know, people listening here, if they want to get involved, if they want to contact you, are there, you know, political action committees, or there lobbying, or ways that people can get into this to help out? What's the best path?
There's a lot of lobbying that's going on among local governments in California. Originally, most places banned cannabis, but more and more places have been allowing it as they realize that they can get in on extra tax revenues, and also put a dent on the illicit market. If they start allowing licenses, they can regulate the system and make some tax money. So I think that's a trend I've been seeing lately, is more local governments opening up and more people lobbying their local politicians to put in place good laws.
So local level first, you think?
I think so. But at the same time, at the federal level, there's really an emerging bipartisan consensus in favor of legalization. And I'm surprised that cannabis legalization hasn't passed yet at the federal level. But it seems to be in the works, and just a matter of hopefully a short time before the federal law changes. And then I think the focus needs to be on reforming the state and local laws to get rid of the corruption and make it easier for regular people to start up businesses.
I think what I'm hearing, though, is there's a concern that these big conglomerates, these corporations, are going to take over the business, when it should be, you know, basically mom and pop stores throughout each state. So how is the best to guard against that, besides fighting for complete decriminalization versus a Schedule II?
Well, I think just making it easier to start up a business, just making it less expensive and less burdensome with the regulations, so it's possible for someone with skills in growing cannabis to maybe get some friends together and get a business off the ground, and so that the best operators can succeed. But I think it's just reducing the taxes and regulations and increasing the number of licenses available.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, there's this one brand I follow on Instagram called Platinum Funk, and they're just known for doing some good grow. And when I DM with this person, they just complain about sometimes how it's so hard for somebody who's really good at growing something, because they make it so difficult to have compliance, to have different statutes, and they have to like go through different, like, what's it called, where they send it to a lab and have testing before it all goes out. They say they make it so hard for someone that doesn't have a lot of money to compete in this space to actually succeed. I mean, are you guys hearing and saying the same thing, or seeing the same thing?
I definitely see, you know, different difficulty in complying with, you know, requirements, and distributors, for example, are the ones responsible for making sure the product gets independently third-party tested. And that probably kind of t- ties into your guys' world, where you're going to end up with product liability or liability if somebody takes something that's, you know, not tested or does, you know, has some type of harmful chemicals in it. But, you know, what I anticipate, yeah, to prevent the big guys from coming, I mean, some people are thinking about that. For example, in California right now, you can't get more than 1 acre of grow space, right? So obviously, if the big boys come in and they do 100 acres and they blow out the grow and they put $100 million in the ground, you know, most people are just not going to be able to compete with that at scale ever. The big thing that I see that's going to happen with the loosening of the federal deschedulization is the problem with cannabis, not only is the banks, is the interstate commerce. You know, being in both New York and California as an attorney, I have clients from New York like, hey, can I grow it in California and ship it? I'm like, no, that's just flat out federally illegal. That's like drug trafficking. You know what I mean? So whether you're complying with your state program, it's still a problem to get it out of state. And I think that once the federal kind of guidelines relax a little bit, you're going to see stuff going all across the states. And that's what I'm interested in seeing, and how that interplays with the regulatory schemes on the local level, which Raza pointed out very well. Is like, there's such a patchwork right now. If you're going to grow in California, you got to be worried about what your local politician thinks. You better get the BCC's approval, and then you better watch out if the feds are coming to look at you. So, you know, once we're able to consolidate some of those regs and have some uniformity across the industry, I think that's going to be major for the supply chain in the country.
I've heard for a lot of people that were doing illegal grows before that after they got the license and are legal, that they think it is safer because they can now insure their product. And I hear a lot of licenses require to have live feeds to the police department within their grows. Have you heard and seen the same thing?
Yeah. So I think you have more chance of securing your product. I mean, I think insurance is still kind of difficult. You're going to have to find the right carrier. I don't think it's just as easy as going to get a policy on your $10 million worth of weed. And they're like, oh, great, sweet. You know, so I think there's still a major challenge with that. But, you know, I think that the security around cannabis is a huge thing, right? I'm sure, Raza, working in the criminal space, you see people get robbed of their weed and street stuff all the time. And a lot of times your street recourse is street remedies. Yeah. You don't really have a recourse. But if you have a permanent grow and you have police watching and all of that, and you're able to show in track and trace, no, this product wasn't diverted, this product was stolen, I think there are a little bit more safety mechanisms. And safety is a health and safety are a top tier concern of both the state and every local municipality.
You're talking about banks they won't lend on this? Like, is it just a bar? Is it a federal thing?
No, you can't. The banks, I mean, Reza, you could probably talk a little bit more about this. My understanding is as though you as a cannabis company, you can't even, they won't even take your money. You're afraid.
Why?
They'll tell you.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, there are some banks that are starting to do it, but not very many. And oftentimes when people are able to get an account for a cannabis business, it gets shut down fairly quickly. So until the federal law changes, it's going to be a problem with the banking. But that's also what creates a lot of the violence and security risks, is the fact that it's all a cash business now. And the bad people know that cannabis businesses are sitting on piles of cash. So it creates a huge incentive for robberies, and, you know, just in terms of transporting the money, storing the money, and the cash nature of the business, it creates more opportunities for tax evasion and so forth, because no one can keep track of where the taxes are going. But they've actually done studies showing that this new licensed dispensaries in areas actually decrease the crime in the area. They increase security because a lot of times they have security guards, cameras, that type of thing. So there's nothing inherently dangerous or violent about cannabis businesses, but it's just a factor of the federal law being what it is, and the large illicit markets that are continuing to go on because the regulations are too burdensome for people to apply for.
So, are people worried or talked all about, you know, say, for instance, illicit drugs, or say, you know, the cartel from down south trying to get into the space and trying to then become more legitimate with their business dealings? I mean, is there thought? I mean, Josiah, you're in this space. Have you heard anything like that coming through?
Oh, definitely. I know in the drafting of legislation and regulations, you know, stamping out the illicit market, the black market, and organized crime is really right at the top of regulators, you know, desires. I think one of the ways they try to do that is, like, for example, we all know, you know, people have corporate entities that protect their interests and all of that type stuff. But when you're a financial interest holder of more than 20% of a business, you as a person have to be disclosed. You as a person have to submit live scans as an individual, right, as a human. So I think those are some of the guardrails around trying to allow, like, you know, illegal cartel money to come in and, you know, corporatize itself and then just fit in with the rest of them, and they can meet the capital demands. And, oh, we also have $500,000 in cash, so we're ready to go. You know, no problem. I think they're still doing a little checking under the hood to know who is the person, you know, responsible for this. And I think that helps it. But, you know, to a degree, I think that they know that that's also happening, right? Because those are the people who not only are well capitalized to enter this marketplace, but also they have the know-how. They've been doing this business for years, you know, under the black market. So it's kind of like it's a known commodity. I'm pretty sure that, that there's this involvement with the cartels.
I think, like, going back to the banking issue, I know there's like the FDIC and they're federally banked and insured, but it seems like this is a booming market. And if I'm a banker, I think, like, I would love to do business with all these cannabis communities. That seems like a ton of cash that would be off the street and decriminalized areas, because I don't live in this space. I don't know anything about it, but I'm hearing this. My first thought was they're walking around with probably $500,000 to $1 million in cash, and they're just going to get robbed. And this is just promoting access to violent crimes. Just put it in the bank, and it helps the banks. It helps everybody. I don't understand why this.
I can give a
banks are chicken. Financial people are chicken.
I think it just takes one bank to be like, we're going to do this. Then they're all full, right?
Yeah, and no, I you know, Raza mentioned earlier, there are some banks. I'm familiar with a few banks that may just on a flyer risk it and take it, you know, and that depends on their relationship with the FDIC and their relationship, you know, with the regulators and what have you, and it's still a risk for them. But I'll give you another example of the federal prohibition causing major problems from a financial standpoint. Even in lending, in terms of like if you have a mortgage on your home and you have some, or your property and you have some type of federal lender, there may be a provision in your lending agreement that you cannot do anything with cannabis or Schedule I illegal drugs. So even if I'm a lessee, I go to you, you know, Bob, as the landlord, and you guys have a mortgage on your property. And then I'm like, can I just do my cannabis business? If the bank finds out that you're leasing to a cannabis person, they may pull your mortgage. They may pull your financing. But it's just because the banks don't want to be outside of their federal guidelines. So it's happening every day where this is a huge problem.
Well, isn't there some people that have, you know, found a way to service the cannabis companies with products that help solve this banking solution? So a lot of these, you know, Ease, for instance, or Relief Club, they're not taking straight cash. I mean, they may for some, but a lot of it is the mobile ATMs.
Yep. And sometimes those go offline. You know, that's the problem. I've seen those be, they have it for a while. Then all of a sudden that one gets shut down. They're scrambling. We got to get a new payment processor in here this week. You know, but yeah, that the mobile ATM is a huge way that they do that, which is trying to circumvent it. So you're not using Visa or you're not using that federal guardrail. You're actually just creating this ATM transaction that charges back to yourself. It's a complicated system, but that's exactly the type of payment.
It's like when I was gambling in college and had to get like all these different checks sent to me from, it was a different offshore account every single time. It's just hilarious, right? Yeah. So Raza, who is in the space? Do you know of anybody that helps with solve this solution of the banking issue for the cannabis companies?
They got to compete probably with maybe these Amazons and Walmarts coming in, being in the space. They're not going to be able to compete unless they can take out a loan. So are there places out there that can help startup companies that want to get into the space be able to do this?
Yeah, there are a lot of companies out there that are trying to provide alternative solutions. But the fact is, until federal law is changed, you know, it's always going to be difficult. And some of these companies that provide financial products, I know that there's businesses that have gotten ripped off by them, had bad experiences. I know some businesses have been charged with credit card fraud criminally by mischaracterizing the transactions that go through them. So really it's just, you know, it's going to be a problem until federal law changes and these large financial institutions are willing to step in. But just in terms of the cartel issues that we were discussing, I think that the cartels and the gangs and all that, those were really created by the war on drugs, which gave them an opportunity to step in and take over the market. Basically, there's always been a huge demand and market for cannabis and other illicit drugs. And when there's a shortage of legal supply, the illegal groups will step in and provide the supply. And they don't rely on contracts and the courts to protect their rights. They rely on force and violence. So the illicit market is just a response to the lack of governments providing a legal market that the operators can operate within. So I think that once we see better state laws and regulations and the end on the federal ban, you'll naturally see the finances work out easier, and you'll see less violence and conflict among the illicit market people.
Well, do you think, I always thought that, you know, when you go to Disneyland with your kids, it should be mandatory that you take a gummy. Yeah. Are we almost there, Josiah? Are we almost there? They just give it to you. Here you are. Check in. Have a good day.
Well, I will say that cannabis has entered a new space of wellness, right? Like, the fact of the matter is that it's a recreational thing. So people are using it just like, you know, any recreational substance to kind of alleviate whatever they want at the end of their day or whenever they do it. But I've seen a lot of increase in the wellness side. And also, again, with that CBD legalization, which comes from the same cannabis sativa plant. So CBD is a cannabinoid, you know, without getting too in depth, it's kind of like a component, and it's the part that doesn't make you high, but it still has some type of medical effects, and it can be anti-inflammatory, it can be antimicrobial, it can have all these quasi-medical benefits, right? So you're just seeing so much of that. Everybody wants to have a CBD company or a gummy now or this and that. And as the market kind of settles itself out and we can get some clinical trials, because there haven't been a lot of clinical trials about how these components and things are affecting the body, I think that there's going to be a lot of science around it. So you're going to be seeing, I mean, I know my grandma takes, both my grandmothers taking CBD, and 10 years ago, I'm sure they wouldn't even admit that out loud, you know, over my mom's, you know, objections. So, I mean, at this point, I think you're going to see a lot more accessibility to this stuff, a lot more study around what is it actually doing to people, and a lot more, you know, use.
Yeah, I mean, my wife has a skincare line. They came out with a CBD line, which they had to take on a separate website, have separate e-commerce. Yeah, you're shaking it. And then the compliance they had to do, the amount they had to spend and all the things just to be able to sell a product that helps people, it was just, it was crazy. And it just makes it so hard in my mind for people that actually know the space well, that are startups, to compete. Like, I'm just worried about that. You know what Russ is talking about? If they open up, like, here, everybody go gangbusters, like City of LA, here's 200 licenses, then you see what fucking happened, right? Like, it's a problem.
I'd like to know, what's your dream scenario? What would you love to happen in the space for the entire community? What would say, like, 12 months from now, this is what I wish it would look like?
I'm happy to start. For me, I just wish the federal prohibition would go away. And then I think that there could be a real... That social equity piece, I think, gets enriched at that point, because you can bring, you know, private dollars, you can bring better public dollars to support these mom and pop applicants, and not only just the social equity applicants. I mean, that's a huge important component of it. New York took on the audacious goal of saying 50% of licensees that are going to be issued from the state have to be from equity applicants. That's like, okay. And again, I'm speaking from a voice of saying, I like that idea, but I don't even know how you get there without allowing people to take better, you know, more access to capital and allowing people to bank and figure out traditional banking mechanisms. I mean, if you are trying to figure out how to grow, the last thing you know is also how to bank at the same time. You know, I mean, I think that there's just that was what I'd like to see. 12 months from now, federal government let go, and that allows a lot more private money and public money to come in and help those social equity applicants.
I would agree with that. The federal law needs to change. That's the biggest change that needs to happen. And that's why we haven't really seen a lot of studies or research on the medical benefits, because it's been impossible to do any type of clinical studies with the federal law being a Schedule I substance. So once the federal law changes, we can actually get a lot more data and information about how this does help people. But we do know that marijuana is essentially a non-toxic substance. So I think we've been seeing a lot more people in the last couple of years, realizing that it can be a great alternative to prescription drugs, which often have all types of bad side effects. And people can basically self-regulate their cannabis intake, knowing that it's non-toxic and there's really no adverse health effects. And we're also starting to see this trend with psychedelics, recognizing all of the medical benefits that they can have and how they can be better than many prescription drugs. And also non-toxic and without the side effects. So I think that also, in addition to the federal law changing, we really need to see local governments, state governments simplify the law, make it actually realistic for regular people to start up these businesses, and also pay special attention to the social equity component. The drug war has caused so much damage to entire communities, you know, taken many fathers in the communities, thrown them in prison, caused many people to distrust the police. And we really need to focus on how we can help the people who have been harmed by these bad policies in the past. get hopefully set up businesses and improve their lives.
Yeah, and I've heard like just recently, you know, very well-known, respected trial lawyer who believes in, they're starting to do the microdosing of psychedelics to help with severe PTSD. And, you know, as a trial lawyer, do a lot of people that are catastrophically injured. And they, I mean, they're talking about when they moved over when using cannabis over the opioids, how it changed their life. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, Josiah's talking about his grandparents using CBD, right?
Our dad started, he's completely anti-drug his whole life. And he's like, oh, the CBD stuff.
Yeah.
It's great. Like he just rubs it on and he feels great. So we're talking about, everyone always said weed was a gateway drug and that's what the big concern, but getting on that, what's next? If cannabis is legalized and becomes like part of everyday life, what's the next kind of drug that is way less harmful than alcohol that should be okay for people to have?
And I would say that the psychedelics, that's what's coming next. It's non-addictive, non-toxic, but it really helps people in a lot of ways. And we're seeing more and more drug rehab and alcohol rehab facilities incorporating cannabis and psychedelics. You know, the old mentality with Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous is sort of a zero tolerance, no substances are okay. And if you smoke a marijuana joint, you've fallen off the wagon and you have to start completely over. So I think that we're starting to realize that these safer substances can actually be incorporated into rehab to help people get off the more harmful substances. And I've heard a lot of examples of opiate addicts who are able to start smoking more weed and get off the opiates. It's a safer substitute, and they call it harm reduction as well. Even if these substances are harmful, they're much less harmful than other substances.
So we have like, you know, ketamine, that's Special K. I see a lot of our chronic pain clients with CRPS, people with severe PTSD, you know, women that are dealing with postpartum depression, they're starting to have ketamine infusions. That's starting to be, you know, a lot of momentum. And like, I've had clients that have had chronic pain for life. They do one round of ketamine, changes their life. Not addiction.
It's just so expensive because it's overregulated and it's almost prohibitive to get something good. And I think it probably stems from drug companies that are making so much money with the current medications that they're afraid of these things.
You know, we all know the predictions around the cannabis market. You know, I'm a cannabis guy. I don't really have a lot of experience with the psychedelics, but it's just a general prediction you heard here first. I think that psychedelics market has potential to be bigger than the cannabis market. I mean, first of all, you're talking about multiple substances, right? Ketamine or the mushrooms or the DMT or whatever it might be. But there's a huge market potential in that because everyone, you know, while cannabis has been unregulated or illegal for the longest time, you know, people like, everyone knew cannabis was readily available. It was a lot harder to get your hands on psychedelics, but as people are moving into this wellness space, again, saying, well, maybe we do microdose some shrooms, you know, then I think that there's a huge market potential that's going to come online in the next few years.
I mean, just think about the marketing opportunities for Nintendo along with Mario on mushrooms.
They've been ahead of the curve.
That guy was shooting fireballs out of his ass and flying around like a raccoon.
You wonder why.
Wow, man. It sounds like a C.S. Lewis novel. All right, guys. So thank you all for coming on for this episode of Justice Team. If you have any questions, media@justiceteam.com. Josiah, where can they find you on the IG or on email? Best
IG at Josiah Young Law. And my email is josiah@josiahyounglaw.com.
Rosa, you go. How are we going to find you, bro?
Thanks. Just if you Google Margolin Lawrence, you can find all kinds of info about us, margolinlawrence.com. If you want to hit me up with an email, it's raza@margolinlawrence.com. But we're happy to help people out nationwide with any cannabis-related issues or criminal cases.
All right. And soon to be getting into psychedelic law, the first.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Thanks for this very wild trip into cannabis law. Brad, anything color commentary to say before we go?
No, but I'm going to go right on to GoDaddy.com and reserve a bunch of websites for psychedeliclawyer.com, psycholaw.com. I'm in it. I'm going to get it.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for coming on for this edition of the Justice Team Podcast.
Remember, no sleep till justice. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Oh, and the jury went wild. I fell into a burning trial by fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 trial by fire.